Kathy and I met each other, I think maybe 2 or 3 years ago. And Kathy and I were on the faculty at Suffolk University. Kathy was professor of finance. And we both were talking about some of the things that she is doing and has a passion for. And now she has a company called Xenoplex, and I'm very proud to be on the board of Xenoplex. And we're also users of the Xenoplex system. I'm going to read what Kathy has written, then I'll give you an example of how we've used this at Stiebel Peabody. Xenoplex is a cognitive relationship platform that uses proprietary machine learning algorithms to better understand the relationships between people, industries, and other entities. These patent-pending algorithms allow Xenoplex to produce highly complete and dynamically updated network maps. Xenoplex provides key decision support platform to its customers to help them make better decisions through the use of the best available data and relationship information. Let me try to explain that. In small towns in agricultural areas, it's always easy to tell who's who. You know, you ask for who is the mullah, who's the priest, who's the rabbi, and they'll tell you, that's the priest, that's the mullah, and that person will be wearing a distinctive garment, so you know that that's the right person. And so they will have a title, and they will have a distinctive garb, and who's the shaman in town? Oh, yeah, well, there's the shaman, and he'll be wearing a distinctive garb, is a distinctive title. In an information society as we have today, all of that has exploded. You know, if you meet somebody and say, well, I'm CEO, what does that mean? Does that mean the person is powerful? And if somebody says, well, I'm a technical advisor, does that by definition mean the person is not powerful? Also, the clothes that people wear increasingly don't give you any tell about where the social status is. One of the things I miss about the military is I could look at somebody, I knew exactly where they were in the pecking order, and I knew if they were powerful or not. But you can't do that in an information society. So what Kathy has done is she's developed these algorithms and using what she calls Xenobots to go into the web and get information about power and relationships. So let me give you a very specific example. In the aftermath of the 2008, we had a big recession. Part of that was because the banks were not being discriminate enough about who they were giving loans to. You all remember subprime mortgages. Well, in the wake of that, the banks, as banks do, went the other direction, and they weren't going to give any loans to anybody who had questionable credit, which created a large opportunity for a certain category of people who were playing on the low end of things. So for example, on when you're dealing on the lower end of society, I may want a new iPhone, but I can't afford a new iPhone, and I don't have a credit card that I could use to buy an iPhone, but I can go into one of these rent-to-buy places. I can rent an iPhone and then eventually buy the iPhone. Same with a television or if I want furniture. And so I had this potential client that had this technology that allowed large retail companies like Walmart to look at an individual and then make a decision about whether or not this person is creditworthy for a rent-to-buy situation. And the idea was to allow places like Walmart to get into the rent-to-buy market, since the banks had abandoned the sort of the lower tier lending area. And he wanted my help for a board search. Now, I'd done a lot of work with the defense industry, and one of the things that happens in defense is they are smart enough to bring in certain admirals, certain generals who are retired, and they put them on their boards. They don't bring any admiral or any general. They bring people who are extremely well-networked and highly valued in the Pentagon. So when it hits the fan, as things inevitably do, they had back channel communications to the right people at the Pentagon. So I was thinking about the same thing for this client, except we would get retired attorney generals from states or federal or associate attorney generals from the federal government. So these would be the independent people. Plus we would get minorities and women. But so that would be the independence. But how do I measure power? And that's where I went to Kathy, because Kathy's technology measures power as defined as how central is this person in other people's networks. And using Kathy's technology, I found a retired associate attorney general named Gonzalez, living in New Mexico, who's extraordinarily powerful, extraordinarily well-connected, and that was through Kathy's technology. I would never have been able to figure that out without Kathy's technology. So that's the way we use it.
Thank you very much.
So, Kathy?
Yeah. All right. So thank you so much for being here. I know a lot of you have very high powers in my database, and it's really truly an honor to have you here. So today, I'd like to talk about a very specific case involve mergers and acquisitions. As you probably know, that M&As are a key part of any company's strategies, and there's a lot of benefit to that. So for example, if you wanted to get into an industry very quickly, you could spend a lot of time developing your own technologies, or you can simply go out to buy an existing company that with proven technology to hit the ground right away. So a lot of companies started doing that, especially in the healthcare industry as well. So Pfizer has also decided to have this new idea of buying innovations instead of doing a lot of things in-house. And once again, there's a lot of benefits to that, because the scientists who owns their own companies has a lot of incentives to innovate, and they capture most of the gains when their company is successful. On the other hand, if you're an employee working at Pfizer, there are so many layers of reporting systems, and it's very hard for anyone to do some real work and at the same time getting compensated when that work hits the market with great success. So I'd like to talk about M&As, and also at the board level, there's a lot of uncertainties when a deal is on the table, right? So it's actually a very complex animal for any board to look at and say, is this really a good deal? Let's quickly look at this case about a OT giant, old-time giant, who's trying to break away from its very old business model, where the products that it's selling is becoming more and more commoditized and very quickly losing its profit margins. And at the same time, the new CEO who come in really wanted to make herself known to the world about how much innovations change in directions that she can bring to the table. So she found this deal. She found this target that not everybody is familiar with. I call D Mini. And it seems that they're really in the frontier of this new business service industry, and that they seem to be really interesting. And so the deal comes to the board, and the board needed to have a discussion. The CEO basically says, I think this is a really good deal, and I'd like to have a all cash acquisition. And we're going to finance this deal with some long-term debts of the company. And I think that this company will open up an entirely new business arena for us to be a good part of. So to start, I'd like to seek your input as to what are the most important things boards should be thinking about, or boards generally start with when faced with such a big ticket item to be decided. Ellen.
Well, I mean, I think there are a lot of different ways to go at it, but I would say I immediately think of three big buckets, and there are many more, but I'll start with strategy.
Strategy.
Well, so where does this fit within the company strategy? And it may be an evolution of strategy, but how does it fit and where do we go with it in the longer run? And in the shorter run, what does it mean for the company in terms of its business, its operation? That's group one and group two, if you will, short-term, long-term business. Bucket three is, how do the numbers come together over the next year and long term? So it's the financial piece of the strategy, it's the financial piece of the short-term operations. And the final bucket is, so if you get it, what are you going to do with it in terms of integration, and how does it actually come together from a people standpoint, from a operating standpoint? So sitting on the board, I start with the strategy, go to the operating, follow with the financials. And so that's the way I would expect a CEO to come to the board with all of that ready. Actually, I'd expect that they would have briefed us before we got to the board so we could be ready with questions on those.
Okay.
Elements.
Very good.
That's the way I would
refer. Thank you. Anyone else? Yes.
I think another bucket would be what's the structure of the deal?
Structure of the deal.
How do you make sure that the goals of the acquired company align with the acquiring company so that you make sure that you get value out of it long term?
Right. So some examples of the structure of the deal?
Well, you have an earn-in. You may do a stock transaction, part stock transaction, so that the people that the previous owner has some stake in seeing this new venture succeed.
Some kind of golden handcuff?
Something like that.
Yeah, see, I think of that as part of the financial piece, but you're right. That's
it's critical.
And the finance piece, too, I'm sure the effect of the shareholders. What's the share price? Is it accretive? You know, what's my long-term? How do I grow over it? I mean, I've seen a lot of acquisitions. They can cascade into a growth problem. So managing that finance track long-term really matters, short and long-term.
Very good. Anyone else? John?
Risk management. How do you identify risks? How do you identify how to determine quickly when those risks are becoming a problem?
And it was in one of the structures, but people really matter. The people management, the human capital, how does it come together? A lot of organizations, one culture can crush another. Some great acquisitions, the smaller acquired company ends up being the culture of the future. I've seen that, pretty interesting. But understanding that going in around how people are going to come together and whether you're treating them as a satellite to grow, or whether you're really bringing them in to embrace and combine and catalyze the organization in a new way.
All right. Okay. So let's get into a little bit of the details. So I'll go back again with you, Alan. So when you talk about strategies, short term versus long term, so as in our case, we have this sort of old-time giant company that's dominating a sort of a declining industry, and they wanted to get into a new space, and they wanted to get into there quickly. So how do you see the vision of the company play out? So do you see very easy transitions or very difficult transitions into sort of a much different business?
So we don't know enough about both companies, right?
Okay.
So we're making, so.
Yeah.
Larry, several of us have mentioned now already people several times. So
mm-hmm.
We need to understand the businesses of both.
Right.
One is a sort of, and the historical one that is sort of the one that's been commoditized
mm-hmm.
still may be a cash cow for that company, right?
Right.
We don't have information on that. So we may want to feed it enough so it generates enough cash as we're shifting the company. So mm-hmm. when you're sitting and looking at the strategy, you need to understand how the cultures will come together, how the businesses will come together, and where you want to be, call it 1 year out, 3 years out, 5 years out, and what it will take to get you there. Because this may be one addition on the way to two or three more additions if you're really transforming a company, or it may be exactly the other half of the puzzle. But then you have to spend some time strategy-wise thinking of what happens. You got to feed yourself on the way, right? And so the
right.
commoditized business may be very important for you in the long run for different reasons.
Yeah, very
is that,
good.
Is that what
mm-hmm.
you want
yeah,
to
so
that?
So at the end of the discussion, I will review the identities of these companies. But for now, I can say that if they had Alan on the board, they could have saved billions of dollars.
Okay.
Now
I'm curious.
You mentioned the operating strategy and how they would approach that, which is in this strategic package. That's critical here too, because the older company, their ability to either bring this company inside
mm-hmm.
or to have to keep it outside is going to be critical mm-hmm. for the success. And they have to understand that strategically about themselves and about the other company. So what you said about operating strategy basically is critical for this.
Well, and the customer model, right? So I may find that I can extend the value of my parent company by bringing in the acquisition, right? Extending the wallet share. So understanding both consumer models and how they come together. Or not. They may just be different markets, new products, new opportunities. But I think my experience has been most companies miss the opportunity to create super users, super customers when they combine or make acquisitions and create that new value. They don't have to leverage it all the time. So that's a space that's worthy of consideration.
Yeah.
You know, I'd like to bring in an earlier program we had at Sea at the Table. We had somebody from Harvard Business School whose name escapes me, and I think you were there, Ellen. And the topic was after action review. One of the great things in the military is if you have a firefight. After the firefight is done and everybody is safe, you review what happened. You have a football game. After the next day after the game, the coach sits down with the team and goes over the videos of the game. What happened? What did we learn from that? And what we were talking about this meeting is that when a CEO is proposing that a board approve an acquisition, the CEO essentially is making certain predictive statements. If we do this, the following good things will happen for shareholders. And so one of the things that I would do is to say, okay, when are we going to have the after-action review? Should it be for a company like this? Maybe it might be 3 years before we really knew what we bought. But we should inform the CEO where we plan to hold her feet to the fire on the predictions that she made, and we're going to go over this and not just forget about it. Because one of the things that we heard from is that most boards don't do that. And so they go in from one M&A transaction to the next M&A transaction. They don't learn from their past experience.
You know, Peter, I'm sorry. Peter Drucker always talked about this in marketing decisions too. If you make a mistake, how can you get out of it? What is the damage if there's a mistake? And that's something you got to think about in advance.
Yeah.
That's a really good point.
There's another issue here because we have a new CEO.
Right.
She's presenting it to the board.
Right.
So, you know, where is the rest of the management team on this and whether this is going to be run as a standalone business or supposed to be integrated in? I've seen so many of these cases where the vice president of merger and acquisition, this is a great deal, but like the team doesn't really want it. And, you know, which you need to have the ownership among either the group that's where it's going to be part of
mm-hmm.
or the team doesn't really want to do it. Otherwise,
so that's why,
go ahead.
So, Fred, that's why I think of that in the pieces that come together at the very beginning,
yeah.
part of that whole integration people thing is part of the initial discussion, because if you catch it, what are you going to do with it? Can you make it work? And you're right, where's the management team? But, you know, part of that is how will you really integrate it and how will the people come together in order to deliver the mission?
I would say it's been my experience that that's probably, regardless of the pro forma that you build, that's one of the most important elements. If teams cannot come together with a common vision and understanding, the deal is going to die. And I've seen it. And it's the most important element is that relationship somehow through that inquisitive process start to be established and understood. And then a plan of action of how it's going to be managed is absolutely essential to success.
Right.
Well, I think it's what all change is. Does the organization, not only the CEO and the board, does the mainline organization feel either the need or the benefits of the change? Because the resistance can be incredible. I remember I lived in Chicago for a long time, and Sears was a big thing. And if anybody remembers the softer side of Sears, that was a big marketing push. And they were trying to change who goes to Sears. Unfortunately, the CEO that brought that in wasn't doing it, quote unquote, the Sears way. And so the senior management rejected it. That CEO was kicked out, and Sears fell back into the old ways, which was losing. And so now there's still every year there's talk about Sears dying. But it's,
yeah.
Does the OTG company, do the people understand that there is a need for change here, or do they think that they're doing well?
Very good point. Very good point. So I'd also like to go back to Ian and Bill's point about making sort of plans making backup plans, basically, if things doesn't go. So basically, the board is presented with a lot of information that included mostly projections, right? So you don't know the future, and all we know is that if this and this works, then something else would happen. So how do boards make plans? So directors, when they vote on the deal, when they agree to the deal, how do they sort of think about if things go wrong, how can we protect our own reputations?
My experience was to board members who've said, when all the finance is done and everything, it's ready to make a decision, the question from the board member was, are you willing to bet your career on this deal? I think I've had that question multiple times over the years, and that was kind of the final, yes, we're all in, you know, as a management team. But I don't know how else you do it. I mean, the people who are sponsoring it beyond the acquisition team, the management team is going to inherit it and run it, literally needs to look the board in the eye with absolute confidence and conviction, and ultimately be willing to put their career on the line.
And their compensation on
the line. We don't talk
about
that. We're negotiating at that point. But it gets there. Quick.
Yeah, there's one thing that strikes me about this, and I was just like reading back through the case study, and reading the signs here that this is a frontier of a new electrical service technology, this company they're acquiring. And so there are plenty of acquisitions that are for, roll up or for, expansion or, taking share or whatever. This one strikes me as probably quite different in that this industry is in a period of upheaval. The big incumbent is having a lot of problems. Whether or not it's through acquisition, they're going to need to find a way for a new path of growth. And, the point about culture, right, it's like whether that comes through acquisition or you're trying to do it organically or whatever it is, that's going to be a problem no matter what, right? But then if you're looking at this deal and thinking about future uncertainty, it's not just in will the people get along and, can you roll the strategies together? You don't even know that this is the right strategy because it's an industry of transition. So there's like a whole extra layer of uncertainty here. And, I'm not sure what exactly that means or what to do about that, but I would think that would need to be taken into account.
Okay. Yeah, that's probably very true, especially when they take on a new CEO whose main task is to take the company to a different arena. Bill, you wanted to follow up on your plans of...
Well, I just think the management team, it's very difficult. You can't predict these things. But the management team, I think, needs to think these things through in terms of what exit strategy there is. I mean, private equity people look at this all the time. So I think it's something that the management team should be presenting to the board as part of the package. hard to do, but I think it's something that's required.
Craig?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think the key, and we've seen in most acquisitions, whether it's just a straight purchase or integrating two companies, is that first 90, 100 days and making sure that you've got real clarity around change. It's much easier to happen quickly, whether it's transition,
right.
And if you let it go longer and people settle in, then it gets a little bit harder.
Yeah.
So that's been our key, and I think having that strategy, understanding the competitive dynamic what is the landscape? I mean, is this technology, is it sustainable? Is it going to be a cool new thing, or is there some other competitor that might have something better? And so, those are some things that we would have thought about.
Okay, very good. All right. So, also, there's a lot of unknowns about the structure of the deal, but the biggest item that sticks out is that this is an all-cash transaction. Any comments on that? Good, bad,
well,
preferred,
did we
not
know,
preferred?
I'm sorry, are these both public companies?
This is,
yeah,
OTG is a big,
is a public,
yeah. The other one is private.
And the other one is private.
Well, that was the structure of the deal. The acquired company's owner can walk away at that point. They have their money, they don't need anything else. They don't necessarily have a skin in the game to future success.
So they did walk away. That's absolutely what happened.
Did I hear you correctly say it was a leveraged deal?
This is a leveraged deal, yes. So the OTG actually borrowed a large amount of long-term debt to finance 75% of the acquisition.
And no clawback because they did cash on the deal? I wouldn't do it. If I don't have a clawback or a rope.
Okay.
So you're saying that the acquired team is critical to the success of this acquisition.
Yes.
And if it's a cash deal, yeah.
That's
a really good question.
I guess what are the retention holds on the people? I mean, are they granted stock options from the acquiring company? I mean, we don't.
Yeah.
We don't know the cash.
Right.
We really don't know the
right.
cash because the cash might actually not have been that high,
right.
And the big ticket for the company being acquired was the employees would get large stock option grants from the company that
right.
was acquiring them and some sort of a contract or something. I mean, we just don't have
yeah.
that information.
Yeah, yeah. Larry warned me about withholding the names, but I will tell you.
I'm just saying it to make some of the decisions we're making.
Right.
We're
right.
making assumptions. We
right.
just don't
so, so let me give you a little more clue. And this is actually one of the very high-profile M&A case that eventually failed. And as you can see, there are so many things that were wrong. One of the things is that the company was really not very excited about its old hardware business anymore. So because the margin's really low, so the company. At the same time of making this acquisition, announced that they plan to spin off the hardware sector.
Oh my goodness! But that was the one generating cash, right?
Correct.
Okay. That's interesting.
That's why I was saying that they should have had you on the board, Alan. The deal itself is valued at $11.1 billion. In cash,
mm-hmm.
and the company,
that's a lot of cash.
And the company took a total debt of $8.5 billion.
And what did that represent of the pre-deal value of the electrical company? Sounds like it was like half the price of the pre-deal.
The company was at pre-deal. The company was valued at $72 billion.
Okay, so 1/7.
So it's 1/7 of the company. 1 year and 3 months later, the company announced a $8.8 billion of write-down.
Oh, good.
Sounds like HP. They did it many times.
CEO bet the job and lost, right?
Yes. So the
can we guess the name of the CEO?
Yeah. Can you do that?
Running for president?
No, it's not that person.
No.
It's actually a much longer name. If anyone can guess, you get the prize of the day.
This is
It's a tricky one.
Yeah, I thought you were going with HPO.
Yeah, I was.
So the name of the CEO was Leo, anyone? Apotheker. No?
Oh, Apotheker.
Yeah.
What's the name of the company?
Oh, this is the company in England, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this,
HP acquired.
Yeah, so HP acquired an England company called Autonomy.
Right.
Oh, okay, so yeah. HP was the acquirer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
well,
that's
what.
Yeah,
well,
so.
Yeah, that's what.
Very good. So before the acquisition, the market cap is $72 billion. Immediately after the acquisition, market cap becomes $46 billion.
This was a due diligence problem. This was a business strategy problem.
There's a lot of problems.
Careful, you may be talking about our next president.
So there's a lot of problems. But the CEO of this company was hired in preference of four internal candidates. So there were four head of printers, head of computer decisions.
Oh, so this wasn't under Carly's.
No,
this was under a different CEO.
Yeah.
It's
after Carly, I think.
Yeah, he's after.
So they had another female.
Yes. Before Meg Whitman.
Before Meg Whitman. That's in between.
Well, that was, is it Mark Hurd then?
Mark Hurd is even before that. So Mark Hurd is a good guy in the entire HP history. Mark Hurd is supposed to be the only good guy.
Depending on who you talk about. That's another setting.
So
should I shut this the recorder off?
So,
what were they going to spin off?
They wanted to spin off the computer.
The computer part.
Nice.
So basically, at the time of the acquisition, they say we no longer wanted to keep the computer and the printer part of it, and we basically want to enter the high margin service sector that IBM enters. But there's a joke that, you know, when a salesman of HP walked into a company with the salesman from IBM, the IBM guy pressed the going up button to see the CEO, the HP guy pressed the going down button to the basement to see the maintenance. So HP hated that. They wanted higher margins on their products and service, and they wanted to get into this autonomy business, which is data service. So autonomy has this software.
So, can I just ask, how often is it that a company wants to just completely change what it does? I mean, it sounds, my original question was going to be, are these two products complementary in some way?
They
wanted to get rid of it, and I didn't ask.
They don't think they're changing that completely.
Yeah,
that's why they're doing it. They think they're doing something complementary.
The word complementary is exactly being presented to the board.
But Kathy, how does this relate to the work you've done?
Yeah, I'm getting there. Okay. Yeah, I'm getting there. So
a question from a board position though is that if you had a circulating CEOs and now you hire someone,
mm-hmm.
and their charge is pretty much to go out and make an act, change the business.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how can you on the board, like the snowball is there, it's going to be tough to say no. This board didn't say no, and they didn't do enough disaster planning or due diligence, but they kind of set themselves up so that.
I think it's just the opposite. I think it's by design. They hired a software CEO. Their hardware company. They hadn't known what they were doing. they should not be surprised that she took them in a software direction.
Well, no, they weren't surprised. Her charge was to go get one. But then the question is, how do you as a board sort of control the situation to make sure the right decision is being made and the right selection?
My point is, I think they brought in a software person on purpose and to take the company in a new direction.
But is your point, how can they say no to
how can
idea?
They, yeah, I mean, yeah. So she comes with her first idea,
yeah.
What are you gonna do? You're gonna say no to your CEO?
Well,
so,
you
one of the
things,
so the way I would approach it is, one of the things that we've always required of our CEOs is, you don't come with a, I get choice of A. You come with a map. You, one of the things you do as a new CEO is you think through the strategy. They knew they brought in a software CEO, come back with the next 3 years, 4 years of how you're going to, where you want to take this company to, how you can transform it, and where you think the strategic M&A deals will be, and what spaces they'll be in. And by the way, talk to us about some of the ideas of the companies you are thinking of looking at, so that when you come back to us in 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, whenever you are, with a deal, we will understand how that fits in the strategy map. We'll understand, you know, sort of the competition, if you will. And so we won't be surprised. We will have bought on. You will have had time to come into the company, think it through, and then we'll have our sort of map, which will change all the time, but at least we'll have a roadmap to start with. And that helps.
Yeah, and we don't have a lot of information, but it would appear that, you know, she came in with an acquisition.
One choice.
And there's no mention of a long sort of planning
thoughtful
session or a thoughtful planning session to get the board there. And the
right
board, having just hired her, given her all kinds of incentives,
right,
what are they going to do, say no? And it also would appear from the careful wording that this is on the frontier of new technology.
Right.
So it's not clear whether they were buying a company, probably not. A product line, probably not.
Or
a product in development.
A dream.
Yeah. What are you exactly you buying? Maybe you're buying innovation. Maybe you're buying something that's an R&D product. And that, again, I'm parsing that very little information. But if you're on the board, one thing you can do is make sure you understand the nature of what it is you're buying.
But on the other hand, there's a lot of controls that could be made. For example, cash versus equity, right? Cash versus equity. So instead of paying the whole acquisition by cash, you could put in the equity piece of it. And what happened when the company loses value based on this deal on their equity side, the proportions of the cash value over total equity changes dramatically, right? So when the company starts, market cap is $72 billion, 11 over 72 is 1/7. But when the equity goes down to 40, 46, the acquisition becomes 25%. So
either from its other performance or because, or in reaction to the announcement of the acquisition, the stock drops.
Yes. Yes. So in fact, the company.
You know, economy guys were smart enough to say, "I'm not taking that risk."
So it turned out that autonomy added 1% of the overall cash flows to HP.
1%.
And took away 25% of its value. So it's quite a disaster. So yes,
it seems
Donna
to me that the problem isn't with the CEO or this particular acquisition, but the configuration of the board, and that the board needs to be changed out. They've had a succession of CEOs and poor performance.
In the case of HP, that's obviously
with
clear.
Focused on the wrong issue.
Right, so that board certainly didn't have a very good reputation after all. So there's a quote here from Forbes magazine that says, "For a decade now, the company has sometimes seemed more like a tawdry reality show than one of the world's greatest enterprise. Dr. Phil could fill a month's worth of shows just examining HP's board, whose dynamics has resembled those of a rival junior high school cliques more than what's supposed to be a sage guiding force." So you're absolutely right about that. So going back to Larry's point regarding how the CEO was picked in the first place, apparently the internal candidate appeared to the board as not having enough reach and connections to the outside, and they wanted to have this person who has dramatic international experience, speak five languages, and worked in five continents. And so they picked, they wanted to pick the really high highly connected CEO. And sometimes, especially in the case of M&A, as our research has shown, that is really pays to use a less connected ones. So we had some statistical results based on S&P 1500 companies from the early 1990s to late 1990s to the end of 2010. And so here's my lecture part. And the results have shown that more connected CEOs tend to make a lot more acquisitions. They tend to make larger acquisitions. They lose money for their shareholders a lot more than their counterparts with less connections. They tend to dramatically overpay. So the overpayment is 30% more than average. So it's quite a dramatic result. On top of that, what's also disturbing is that most of the time after the deal, these CEOs tend to demand higher pays from the board due to the fact that now he's managing a larger company. And he also goes out to receive a lot more CEO awards and honorable degrees. And when he have to be out, he tend to jump to a bigger company with better pace. So
should we use your database in order to develop stocks to short?
you can.
Well, you can.
That's one thing we're working on.
Right? Yeah. Larry wanted to use it to hire a CEO, but I'm thinking maybe we should be shorting stocks.
We ought to put together mutual funds.
Right, very good. So the counterpart to all of this is that you needed to have a powerful board. So powerful directors like the likes of Alan could dramatically change the outcome of the results. So our in a sister paper that we worked on, we showed that boards with more powerful directors work better and they constrain the CEO better. The CEOs in those companies do not make as many mistakes as
For the sake of those who were to your last program, could you operationally define what you mean by power?
Okay, yeah, so we actually have different definitions of power and influence. So power is a more macro measure to show your overall positions in the network. So we define the index between 1 and 100, 100 being the highest, and a high-powered executive will be the one that's over 85 or 90 or higher. So by having a powerful person, you basically imagine this person sitting at the crossroad of different highways. So this person receives information from a lot more sources. This person could stop information if he chooses to, because he's a hub or a bridge. So he can stop the flow of the information if he chooses to, and he can reach literally everybody in the network with a small number of steps, and the people who are connected directly to this powerful person tend also to be powerful. So that's sort of an overall definition of a power. Influence, on the other hand, is a more limited definition. So for example, I speak with Alan 3 times a day, I wish. So our frequencies of communication shows that she can pass her ideas to me. But if my only way to obtain information is through Alan, she would have great influence on me. If I have many, many different sources to obtain information, then I would not necessarily be strongly influenced by one person. So depending on her network position and my network position, we can define who is the bigger influencer and who is the one who's being influenced.
Okay. If I can take the mirror image of what Kathy just said, we had Mick, I forgot his last name, but
somebody from WilmerHale came,
McBain,
and he was talking about a lawsuit in which a private equity dominated board made a certain decision that turned out to be a disaster, and other shareholders sued the board for that decision, and the board said we had independent, it wasn't just the private equity partners that made the mistake, we had these independent people on the board, so it was a fair and impartial decision. The accusers said yes, legally they were independent, but they were not very powerful because they owed their position to the fact that the private equity partners put them on the board, and they had no other base of power other than the private equity firm. So legally they were independent, but they were not in a very powerful position to contradict the PE people. Therefore, it really wasn't a fair and honest decision. So that's going on in the courts right now, in the Chancellery in Delaware.
Yes.
So the issue about independence and power on the board are two different issues. You can be independent and not be very powerful.
So how do you change the weights then? How do you adjust to get the right balance?
We did look at this. So basically, we needed to have a majority of the board being powerful directors for them to be able to voice their real concerns.
But determined by what criteria? Quantitative, qualitative process? I mean, how do you get to that? It seems subjective to me.
So our power and influence measures are based on network science. They are actually very objective and quantitative. So this whole calculation needs to get into supercomputers that has hundreds of gigs of memories to take in this information and spit out the power indices after 7 days.
But you're assuming that permission has been granted through that person, through that social network, that you can measure that, no?
So that's what our technology is about. So we basically go out to obtain public sources to understand relationships. So
we don't need your permission.
So we don't obtain any permissions.
But you're also making an assumption that when you measure their outside influence.
Yes.
You have also measured their inside the board influence. And someone could be very powerful on the outside, but once you have the dynamics of the board, they behave differently, or someone on that board, based on the way they have conducted themselves in that group over the last 2 or 3 years, may not be famous to the rest of the world, but everybody in the room looks there first.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I guess I would sort of following on a little bit of the skepticism there, wonder whether measuring from the outside does in fact come up with the same measurement from the inside.
That's a very good point. At this point, we do not have the data to look at that. But some boards in Israel actually has been releasing board minutes. So the world is knowing more and more about the internal dynamics.
Oh, you can't know anything.
You wouldn't know anything about my boards from our
board. No way.
Those have been rewatched 3 times.
Right.
Exactly.
By the way, let me, Ed, my role as timekeeper, it's 6 o'clock. If anybody needs to leave, feel free to do so at this time. If anybody wants to stay, feel free to do so.
Okay. Wow, thank you.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Given this topic, is influence and power situational?
No, at this point, no. So once again, it's based on our data on your relationships in the professional space. So all of this data come from your past experience and achievements. So once this data is in, it's entirely objective, it's obtained by third-party sources.
Power seems to be the absolute. Influence seems to
me to be relative, given the statements just made. Another example is a person who's very powerful in the workplace goes home and takes orders from their spouse.
Influence the situation.
That's every guy I know.
Well, it seems that there's also room for false flags, right? So I can retain the services of outreach companies and populate the internet with, you know, images of myself all day long and you know, anything I want to say.
All those likes on Facebook are not true.
On Facebook,
right.
So my influence would probably not show well. So
yeah, that's why our robots tries to look at information based on your career history and your past achievements. A lot of things that you cannot fake. So for example, when we connect your performance at certain companies with the company's historical financial record, we can understand your style of management. And things like that, it's very difficult for you to go in and change. So the power measure is not only a contemporaneous measure, but also a historical measure. So it shows you every year as you move along in the social network, in the professional space,
yeah,
to capture whether you're moving up or moving down. So let me
give you an example. So I worked for a publicly traded company, and when I came in to lead strategy, we were trading at $20 a share. When I left, we were at $130 a share.
It would be captured, yes.
Yeah, my ego is pretty big, but there's no way that I could take credit. I mean, there's other conditions, environmental conditions that drove that stock,
mm-hmm,
that had nothing to do with business strategy. So it could be a false flag unless you're really underneath the quantitative components of it. You know,
yeah.
What was happening,
yeah,
at the board level? What was happening with shareholders?
Right.
There were had nothing to do with, you know, those great PowerPoint presentations.
But on the other hand, being lucky is random. Being consistently lucky is very difficult. So if you have climbed the corporate ladder to be consistently right, then you must know something. You can't be lucky all the time. Or you be just so lucky that you really should have go out to buy lottery tickets.
And then there's another issue too. If let's say everyone on the board has a rating of 85 to 100, so they're all very powerful. But you put all these powerful people in a room,
uh-huh,
face to face.
They start fighting.
Does that work out in terms of
a good
outcome? And the other thing, if the board is diverse, let's say you have a surgeon who has a great network, and you have a someone from a large nonprofit, and you have a CEO and some venture capital, they all may have lots of power in their own area,
mm-hmm,
but whether or not it's going to be for the collective good of the corporation isn't totally clear.
Yeah,
right.
What I'm seeing here is you know the old political science definition of power is power is the ability to get people to do what you want them to do, whether or not they want to do it or not.
Yeah.
And what I hear is that when you're using the word power, you're going to that political definition of I can get you to do what I want you to do, even if you don't want to do it. That's power. I think Kathy's using the word, the same word, in a slightly different way, which has to do with how central this person is in other people's networks, which is not the same as political power, which is the ability to I totally agree. You get a bunch of politically powerful people in a room, not all the people, the same people, are going to walk out of the room intact. But Kathy's definition is not that.
So is it more reach and influence then?
I would say is how the degree to which you are central in other people's networks versus peripheral in other people's networks. For example, I got did you know I got 5,000 people on my LinkedIn network? Am I cool or what? The answer is you don't know, because 5,000 LinkedIn contacts may mean absolutely nothing. I may not know them. I may not be able to influence them. So that number on LinkedIn is a meaningless number. What Kathy's really talking about is how central am I in other people's networks versus how peripheral am I, which is more an issue of the degree to which what I say is going to matter to other people. And again, in an information society, one can make an argument that that is power.
Or it's a component of power.
It is a component.
Could you just explain again what the difference between power and influence is then again?
Okay.
Because it sounded to me almost like
yeah.
defining influence right. instead of power.
Well, yeah, so I think influence is more local and power is more global.
I see.
Yeah, so you're influencing the people that's directly connected to you, where your power shines through the world.
I see.
but how do you get to that? So I understand a little bit about how the algorithm might work in the bots, but how would you get to the space where, you know, it's one thing to look at what's available in the public domain and influence, and then maybe the lineup of performance that might be publicly available. But how do you get to the point of, I understand I'm calling you three times a day and we're having a conversation, or I'm sending 50 emails out
right.
a day to these
very
key
good
people
yeah.
unless I give you permission
right.
into that.
Yeah,
domain.
So I don't need that. That
you
was
don't
just,
need that.
Yeah, that was a very.
So your algorithm's over.
So let me explain this. So for example, if I wanted to see Alan's relationship to Larry, I basically look for information where it says Alan attended Larry's event. Alan commented on Larry's post. Larry spoke about Alan in this and this terms, and Alan and Larry made a deal. So it's this kind of repeated transactions that I'm trying to capture.
So your algorithms use semantic analysis, not just
contextual analysis.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So you're going to force us all onto Facebook, and we're all going to have to be blocking our Facebook.
That's already true.
You're looking so much at technology transactions, but you're really not able to evaluate, or can you, if I pick up the phone and talk to somebody directly, because you're not seeing
no.
that on Facebook and LinkedIn.
No.
People still do that?
Right.
No, but the propensity, your targets are going to be pretty close to. I mean, this will look like a big heat map in a data analytics, right? You're going to be able to see. Maybe, I'd love to see what a sample output would look like.
No, but
on my laptop, I can show it to you.
Yeah.
The people I think that are powerful or influencers are the ones that can get somebody to answer the phone.
Right. Yeah.
I can get that person on the phone, or I cannot. And if they can, they're pretty powerful.
It may be that there's a couple different flavors of this. There's the connected, technological, powerful, and then there's a slightly different flavor, which you can't capture, which is the more interpersonal, powerful.
Right. There are definitely things we cannot directly observe, but there's a lot of things we can model, and we have a scientist that specialize in probability Bayesian modeling to basically understand, okay, if I do this with Alan 50 times, what does it mean to our relationships? And sometimes the semantics will tell us that, you know, I and Sean, we actually hate each other, even though we are connected through Facebook and LinkedIn. But if you see these articles about we bickering about each other's decisions, then this is another piece of information that's currently not available in any kind of domains. So Larry will not come to me and say, hey, you know, I'd really like to talk to Sean. Can you make an intro? but otherwise, without this information, it seems that yeah, we're connected and we're friends.
I also think there's a time dimension to this. I think about George Herbert Walker Bush, who is an extraordinarily good influencer, and a very low key kind of guy, but he's constantly on the phone talking to people. And everybody's going to take George Herbert Walker's book, George H.W. Bush's Call. But he probably doesn't have a Facebook page, and he probably doesn't have a Twitter account. He's probably in his 80s.
90.
Okay. God bless him.
But I suspect that anybody who is 40 and younger, who is seeking to be an influencer, is both on the phone and on social media at the same time. And so we're looking at a sort of a generational issue. So that if we look over time, there's going to be an increasing correlation between the two.
Well, I mean, obviously.
But it will always be the case that not everybody who's on social media is going to be powerful.
Well, it's the first sign of that was the early bloggers who were picked up by corporations to, you know, be on their payroll and start
right.
writing stuff about the next product and services. In HB Harvard Business Review, there was a case about Velveeta cheese. They were talking about super users. I don't know if anybody read that. And
they're all dead.
So the product was kind of lingering, and they were just kind of questioning, you know, and then they got underneath with the big data analytics, and they realized these were very loyal kinds of people committed to this product, and they created all these product extensions, you know, through that analytics, and now there's a spectrum of Velveeta-type products that people can buy, and they're killing it with the numbers. So they created more wallet share out of this, I think it's cheese. Do these bots get to that level where a consumer-driven product, a consumer-product company would say?
That's one of our future directions. So
okay.
So basically, our key technology is at the very foundation is to understand who is who. So we understand. This Ian is not that Ian, so that we can know a lot about each individual automatically, and we're able to combine with additional data sources to get into that kind of understanding of consumer behaviors.
As Ann knows, for example, in consumer research, we spend so much time trying to find the difference between the influencers, as you know, and the ones who just follow along.
Yeah, you could throw that product right now at the blog universe and generate a whole income stream for your company.
All right, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I hope you can join us next month. We are going to have Barry Koslow here. Barry was chairman of the board of a hospital that went bankrupt. And so the topic is going to be what is your responsibility as a board member in a nonprofit if the nonprofit starts heading towards bankruptcy?
He did the one down in Western.